Imagine, just for a second, the most complex thing you'll ever know. It's not out there in space. It's right here, inside your head. Your brain. It shapes everything, right? Thoughts, feelings, memories. But what happens when it runs into trouble? Or just, you know, gets older?
Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive. Today, we're jumping headfirst into neuropsychology. We've sifted through a ton of research, articles, expert notes to try and give you a really clear picture of how the brain works and, well, where it can go wrong.
That's the plan. We want to unpack the brain's vulnerabilities, look at how we even begin to classify its disorders, and really get a handle on this amazing complex link between our minds and, well, the physical brain itself.
Yeah, get ready for some genuinely surprising facts, I think. Some real aha moments. Hopefully you'll come away feeling like you've got a much richer understanding, not just of the brain, but of people, of yourself. So let's dive in. Okay, let's start with something most of us probably worry about a little bit. Getting older. Yeah. And that feeling that, you know, mental decline is just inevitable, is it? Are we all just sort of doomed to slow down mentally?
Well, it's a really common belief, almost a cultural narrative, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But some fascinating recent research, like the work Ramsgar and his colleagues did, It actually suggests that maybe those older studies were a bit skewed.
Skewed how?
Well, they often average data from people who are already, maybe unknowingly, in the very early stages of things like Alzheimer's or dementia.
Hmm.
But when you design the tests carefully, control for those factors, You actually find something pretty remarkable.
Which is?
That brain performance in older age can actually increase. It really flips the script on what we think healthy aging looks like.
Wow, okay. Brain performance increasing with age, that's huge. But it does raise a question, doesn't it? How can something that helps us when we're young, you know, evolutionarily speaking, actually cause problems down the line? Is there a biological reason for that kind of trade-off?
There is, yeah. It's a concept called antagonistic pleiotropy. It sounds complex, but the idea, proposed by George Williams way back in the 50s, Is basically that a single gene can be beneficial early in life, maybe helping with survival or reproduction, but have negative effects later on.
Oh, okay. So evolution favors the early benefit, even if there's a cost later.
Exactly. The early advantage outweighs the later downside from a purely evolutionary standpoint. And we see actual examples like Laurent dwarfism. Comes with developmental challenges, obviously, but also gives amazing resistance to diabetes and some cancers. Or Huntington's disease. It's devastating later, but it usually hits after reproductive age. And interestingly, it's linked to increased fertility and lower cancer risk earlier on.
A double-edged sword.
Precisely. Even things like sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis can offer protection against other diseases in certain situations. It's fascinatingly complex.
They're thinking about society. Populations are aging so rapidly everywhere, right? Japan, Germany, Poland.
Yeah.
You mentioned the stats earlier. Why is understanding this healthy brain aging so critical now?
Because it fundamentally changes how we approach aging as a society. If decline isn't inevitable, we need to focus on promoting lifelong well-being. It's about quality of life, reducing healthcare burdens. It's massive. And on a practical level, things people can actually do.
Yeah.
What research suggests, things like regular musical activity. Simple, enjoyable, but it seems to really help maintain cognitive resilience as we age. It's accessible, too.
Playing an instrument or even just listening actively.
The research covers various forms of engagement. It seems the multimodal nature of music is key.
Okay, so that's the more optimistic side. But what about when things do go wrong, when the brain's mechanisms get disrupted? How do different fields like neurology, neuropsychology, psychiatry, how do they approach this? How do we map out what's happening?
Well, the first thing to grasp is just the sheer scale. We know of over 1,000 distinct brain diseases.
1,000? Wow.
Yeah. It just shows how incredibly complex this organ is.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, how many ways things can be disrupted.
And the cost. You mentioned some figures earlier that were just staggering. Europe, $800 billion back in 2010, doubling in 5 years. U.S. figures for Alzheimer's, depression. I mean, what do these huge numbers really tell us beyond the obvious financial strain?
They tell us these aren't just individual issues. They're massive societal challenges. They hit healthcare systems, the economy, families, everything. It highlights the absolute urgency for research, for better prevention, for effective treatments. We have to focus resources here.
And what are the common triggers for these neuropsychological problems?
Well, common causes include things like strokes, physical injuries, brain tumors, developmental issues, too. And one type of injury getting a lot of attention now is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. especially in athletes.
Right, the football player study.
Yeah, that finding 110 out of 111 deceased American football players showing CTE signs was shocking. And the scary part is the delay. Symptoms like headaches, memory loss, disorientation, even dementia and suicidal thoughts. They often don't show up for a decade or more after the hit stopped.
Makes you think, doesn't it? About concussions, even minor bumps. And you mentioned mental illness. It's crucial to stress these are brain diseases, right? Often biochemical, not just, you know, lack of willpower.
Absolutely. And that understanding has evolved. There was the anti-psychiatry movement back in the 60s questioning the whole concept. But science has largely moved past that. More recently, you have the neurodiversity movement, rightly advocating for acceptance of conditions like autism.
Which is important.
Definitely. But it's a complex conversation. Sometimes the focus on acceptance for less severe cases can inadvertently downplay the really debilitating struggles faced by those with severe mental illness. We need nuance.
Right. And Eric Kandel, the Nobel laureate, he laid out some key principles back in 98.
Yes, basically emphasizing that mental processes are brain processes, that genes and environment both shape the brain, and crucially, that even things like psychotherapy physically change the brain. They affect gene expression, brain circuits. It's not just talk.
Mind changing the brain.
Exactly. And building on that, there's been a big shift in classification since around 2008 with something called RDOC, Research Domain Criteria.
RDOC.
Yeah. Instead of just using diagnostic labels like depression or anxiety, RDOC tries to understand disorders based on disruptions in large brain systems, like systems involved in negative emotions or positive emotions and reward, cognition, social processes, arousal. Six main domains. It's about looking deeper across multiple levels, genes, molecules, circuits, behavior, get a more biologically grounded understanding. It's called phenomics.
Okay, let's get into some specifics then, starting with something universal. Pain. It's so subjective, isn't it?
Hugely subjective. Our brain has this complex network, the pain matrix, that processes not just the sensation, but links it to emotion, memory, attention. It can even generate pain without any actual injury signal from the body. Phantom limb pain is an example.
Right.
And then there's a really strange condition called asymbolia of pain. Damage to connections between key areas, the insula and cingulate cortex, means the person feels the painful stimulus but doesn't interpret it negatively. They might even laugh. It's bizarre.
Wow. And you mentioned masochism linked to dopamine?
Yes. Specifically, excessive dopamine release in the VTA, part of the reward pathway. The pain somehow triggers pleasure signals and, of course, common things like migraines.
Yeah.
Incredibly prevalent, especially among women, really costly due to the debilitating pain and other symptoms.
Okay, moving to schizophrenia. Bleuler's splitting of the mind affects about 1% of people.
That's right. And while we often associate it with hallucinations and delusions, the content of those experiences can vary massively depending on culture.
How so?
Well, studies found voices in the U.S. are often reported as harsh, threatening. But in places like India or Ghana, they might be described as playful or annoying, but less violent.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and the delusions might focus on family issues of Pakistan, workplace gossip in Japan. Culture really shapes the experience. And interestingly, sometimes these experiences seem to be preceded by mind pops, just random intrusive thoughts.
And we know there are physical brain changes, right? Like enlarged ventricles?
Yes, enlarged ventricles, reduced hippocampus size. Those are often observed. But the really cutting-edge stuff is with organoids.
Mini brains.
Sort of, yeah. Grown from stem cells of people with schizophrenia, they actually showed abnormal development of connections really early on.
Which means maybe prenatal treatment one day.
It opens that possibility, yes. It's still early days, but it's a huge potential breakthrough.
And the cultural link extends to religious delusions, too.
Very much so. They seem most common in specific, highly religious environments or contexts, like among Vatican exorcists. There was even a documented rise in perceived possessions after popular horror films came out.
So belief systems play a huge role.
It seems so. Germany actually banned exorcisms after the tragic case of Annelise Michel, who likely had epilepsy, not possession. It highlights how these phenomena are culturally situated.
Okay, what about mood disorders? Depression, for example.
Depressive disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, characterized by the deep sadness, loss of pleasure, anhedonia, sleep problems, sometimes suicidal thoughts.
Statistic 15% commit suicide. That's chilling.
It is. And there's a clear genetic component, about a 48% concordance rate in identical twins.
And bipolar disorder, the swings between highs and lows.
Right. Formerly called manic depressive psychosis, usually emerges around age 20. You have the depressive phases, but also these manic episodes. Mania involves euphoria, tons of energy, poor judgment, grandiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But it can also be a period of intense creativity for some.
It's like the positive disintegration idea.
Exactly. Kazimierz Dąbrowski's theory. That these intense psychological crises, if navigated well, could actually lead to personality growth. It's an interesting perspective.
Now, this concept of disorders of will, you said it's relatively new in formal classification, but the idea goes way back.
Yeah, Theodore Roop talked about it in the 1880s, but it only got into the main diagnostic manual, the DSM, in 2013.
And it covers things like addiction. How does reframing addiction as a disorder of will change things? It sounds like it moves away from just blaming people.
Precisely. It acknowledges these are complex psychophysiological issues, not just moral failings. It includes addictions, alcohol, drugs, gambling, even workaholism, eating disorders, and also impulse control disorders like kleptomania or pyromania. The brain's reward system, especially the nucleus accumbens, is heavily involved.
So it's biological.
Addiction involves real molecular changes in the brain. It alters how neurons function, how networks operate. So yeah, the traditional moral condemnation isn't very helpful. These conditions are often linked to cognitive problems that actually impair the person's ability to remember or weigh the negative consequences of their actions. Treatment needs to address that.
Which brings us to some really tough ethical ground, doesn't it? You mentioned cases like Charles Whitman, the Texas Tower shooter, who had a tumor pressing on his amygdala, or cases where things like pedophilia disappeared after a tumor was removed. If behavior is so tied to brain biology, what does that mean for justice?
It's a profound question. Does it shift the focus from pure retribution towards rehabilitation, towards fixing the underlying biological issue if possible?
Or re-education, perhaps.
Or re-education. There are no easy answers. But neuroscience is forcing us to ask these fundamental questions about responsibility and the punishment.
Let's shift focus now and we go deeper. Down to the molecular level, how does the brain actually process information?
Well, neurobiologist Ira Black had this great perspective. He argued that thinking, learning, communication, it all happens at the molecular level. He called neuromolecules both the hardware and software of the brain. They are the information.
Hardware and software, I like that.
And the complexity is just mind-boggling. Think about it. Just four key neurotransmitters, each having maybe three different concentration levels. That alone gives you 81 possible states.
Wow.
The brain's molecular orchestra is incredibly sophisticated.
And this molecular activity is the basis for neuroplasticity, right? The brain changing itself.
Exactly. Whether it's learning something new, development in childhood, or compensating after an injury, it's all driven by changes in connections at the molecular and cellular level.
That phrase again, the brain changes the mind, and the mind shapes the brain.
It really captures it. We have key players like acetylcholine, dopamine, serotonin, the neurotransmitters acting at specific synapses, and then neuromodulators like nitric oxide or neuropeptides, which can spread more widely and tune the activity of larger brain regions. It's a complex interplay.
Which brings us to substances that affect this interplay. Psychoactive drugs, Aldous Huxley's doors of perception idea.
Right. He thought psychedelics like mescaline worked by reducing the brain's filtering mechanisms, letting more raw perception through.
Is that how they work?
Well, early studies showed increased activity, but more recent fMRI research, looking at psilocybin, the compound in magic mushrooms, actually shows it decreases activity in key hub areas like the medial prefrontal cortex and anterior cingulate cortex. These are involved in self-reflection, emotional regulation, kind of like the brain's main control centers or filters.
So it quiets them down.
Exactly. It seems to cause a kind of deregulation, allowing other brain areas to connect and communicate in new, unusual ways. Less inhibition. That's why it might be helpful for conditions like severe depression, where people get stuck in rigid, negative thought patterns. It shakes things up.
And what about microdosing? Taking tiny amounts.
Yeah, that's gaining popularity. People report benefits like mood improvement, less stress, better focus. But the science is still catching up. There are potential downsides, too. Some reports suggest it might increase neurotic tendencies or cause visual disturbances for some. More research is definitely needed.
Okay, and marijuana. Cannabinoids.
Right. The active compounds. Interestingly, our brain makes its own cannabinoid called anandamide. It's linked to feelings of well-being, like the runner's high.
Huh. And the risks of marijuana use?
It's complicated. The research is often contradictory, partly because legality has limited good studies for so long. Many sources suggest alcohol is generally more harmful. But now, with increasing legalization, we're starting to get better. More controlled research on both its potential benefits and harms.
Then there are nootropics. Smart drugs.
Yeah, things intended to boost cognitive function. Caffeine is the obvious one, but also modafinil, certain amino acids, vitamins, herbs like gigobiloba.
Do they work?
It really varies. And importantly, what helps a brain that's recovering from injury might not do much or could even be harmful for a healthy brain.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be cautious and never underestimate basic diet. Remember the hamster study? B3 deficiency caused severe behavioral issues, reversed just by adding the vitamin.
Right.
And studies in prison show better diets correlate with less aggression. Nutrition is fundamental for brain health.
Which leads to this whole idea of neurohacking, using substances or even brain stimulation to enhance ourselves. What are the ethics there?
That's a huge question for the future.
Right.
Who gets access? Who decides what counts as an enhancement versus treatment? Where do we draw the line? We'll be debating this for decades.
Okay, let's talk about something we all do, but maybe don't appreciate enough. Sleep. It varies so much, doesn't it? By age, but also culture.
Absolutely. We tend to think of one long sleep block monophasic sleep as normal. But historically, biphasic sleep, like with a siesta, was common. And some people experiment with polyphasic sleep, multiple short naps, like that every man three schedule, though it's pretty intense.
Is there anything shorter? For when you're just exhausted?
Well, there's NSDR, non-sleep deep rest, also known as yoga nidra. It's a guided practice, usually short, maybe 10, 20 minutes. It promotes deep relaxation and seems to help with mental fatigue and fostering neuroplasticity, a quick recharge.
Interesting. And sleep in animals is wild, right? Dolphins sleeping with half a brain.
Yeah. Or birds sleeping with one eye open while flying or in a flock. It suggests this idea of partial sleep might even happen in humans to some degree. It could explain those rare people who genuinely seem to need very little sleep. Maybe parts of their brain are getting rest even while they seem awake.
But for most of us, full sleep is essential. You mentioned clearing toxins.
Yes, the glymphatic system. It's like the brain's waste disposal system, using cerebrospinal fluid to flush out metabolic byproducts that build up while we're awake. It mostly happens during deep sleep.
Wow. So sleep is literally cleaning your brain.
In a way, yes. And regulating organs, consolidating memories. It's incredibly busy work. We have distinct phases.
REM and non-REM.
Right. REM rapid eye movement sleep. That's about 20-25% of sleep. Lots of brain activity, dreaming, eye movements. But your body muscles are temporarily paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Crucial for procedural memory skills, habits. Then NREM, non-REM sleep. This includes the deepest stages, slow wave sleep. SWS, really important for declarative memory facts, events, and physical restoration.
And what controls it all?
Our internal body clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, SCN, and the hypothalamus, syncs us to the light-dark cycle. And chemicals like orexin play a key role in keeping us awake or letting us fall asleep. Lots of orexin causes narcolepsy.
So why do we sleep? What are the main theories? Survival? Energy saving?
Those are part of it. But memory consolidation is huge. That study showing people were twice as likely to solve a complex problem after sleeping on it.
Sleep inspires insight.
It really seems to. The brain isn't just off. It's actively processing, restructuring information and maintaining neuronal health, clearing waste. It's vital housekeeping.
And we can even sort of see dreams now.
It's incredible. That 2012 study using brain scans, they could predict the general category of dream content, like seeing a person versus an object, with pretty high accuracy just by looking at brain activity before waking someone up.
Mind reading, almost.
Getting closer. And children's dreams are fascinating, too. Very young kids often have static, simple dream images. It's only around age 7, as certain brain areas mature, that dreams become more like stories with an active self in them.
And the full moon thing, does it really affect sleep?
There's some evidence it might lead to slightly shorter, lighter sleep. The evolutionary idea is maybe our ancestors were more active or needed to be more vigilant during brighter nights. Still debated, though.
Okay, so we've established the brain affects the mind. But the big question, maybe the biggest, can the mind, our experiences, our thoughts, change the brain back?
Absolutely. That's the core principle behind why psychotherapy works. Regardless of the specific approach, it leverages neuroplasticity.
How? What are the key ingredients?
Well, Cozzolino outlined 5 key things. First, the person has to want to change. Motivation is key. Second, therapy reinforces those desired changes through talking, practicing new behaviors. Third, emotion is crucial. Heightened emotion actually increases plasticity, makes the brain more changeable. Fourth, therapy provides the context to direct those changes constructively. And fifth, without that context, strong emotion could just lead to random, unhelpful brain changes. So therapy guides the rewiring process.
That makes so much sense. And it connects to things like meditation too, right?
Definitely. Meditation seems to work in part by quieting down those parasitic background processes, the constant mental chatter, worries, anxieties that drain energy.
Frees up resources.
Exactly. It allows for more focused attention, better brain synchronization, more efficient mental functioning. You're reducing the noise.
And different cultures harness this in different ways.
For sure.
Yeah.
Tanya Lerman studied Protestant church members who learned to interpret spontaneous thoughts as God speaking to them. That's a powerful way of shaping inner experience. Or in Tantric Buddhism, practitioners visualize and identify with a chosen deity. It's a profound reshaping of self-identity at a neurological level.
So the big takeaway here really is this two-way street. Brain influences mind, mind shapes brain.
It's a continuous loop. And there's even this concept of causal emergence. Mm. It suggests that sometimes higher level descriptions like our thoughts, language, mental states can actually have more causal power, more influence than just looking at the firing of individual neurons.
The whole is more than the sum of its parts, causally speaking.
Kind of, yeah. It's a complex idea, but it suggests that mind level phenomena are genuinely real and impactful, not just byproducts of brain activity.
And now we have technologies that can directly influence this neuroplasticity.
We do. Things like neurofeedback, where you learn to control your own brain waves, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, using magnetic pulses to stimulate or inhibit brain areas, direct current stimulation, DCS, using weak electrical currents. These offer targeted ways to potentially treat conditions or even enhance function by directly modulating brain activity and plasticity.
Which loops back to those ethical questions we touched on earlier. Who gets to decide how we use these powerful tools?
Exactly. It's probably one of the biggest ethical frontiers of the 21st century. How do we manage the power to intentionally reshape the human brain?
A lot to think about.
Indeed. And maybe one final provocative thought to leave listeners with, drawing from Carl Jung. He talked about menticide, the killing of minds. He warned that the greatest danger to human consciousness wasn't necessarily external forces, but our own vulnerability to psychic epidemics. Things like mass delusions, ideologies.
Fostered by controlled narratives or totalitarian systems.
Precisely. The idea that our collective psychology is vulnerable, that minds can be subtly manipulated on a mass scale. It's a chilling reminder to stay critical, to protect our own inner landscapes.
Wow. What a journey today. From questioning aging myths to the costs of brain disorders, the intricacies of sleep, the power of therapy, we've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. It underscores just how fragile and yet how incredibly resilient the brain is. It's this constant dance between vulnerability and plasticity. Hopefully it gives everyone listening a moment to pause and think, maybe about the ethical challenges ahead, or maybe just to appreciate the sheer wonder of what's going on inside their own head right now.
Absolutely. So what stands out most to you from this deep dive today? Lots to ponder. Thank you, everyone, for listening.